Welcome to Washington Today for October 4th, 2021. I'm Gary Sterkoff. Thanks for joining us today. Here are some of your headlines. President Joe Biden has told Republican senators to, quote, get out of the way and let Democrats deal with the nation's debt limit on their own. We'll hear more from the president in a moment. An oil pipeline off the coast of Southern California has spilled more than 100,000 gallons of oil into the Pacific Ocean, shutting down beaches and damaging local wildlife habits. The spill happened about 5 miles off the coast of Huntington Beach. That's in the L.A. area. Local officials estimate about 3,000 barrels or 126,000 gallons of post-production crude were released into the ocean. The cause remains unknown. And if you couldn't get on Facebook or Instagram today, you weren't alone. The two popular social media apps, along with the text messaging app WhatsApp, were down all across wide portions of the world today. Company officials did not say what caused the outage, which began around 11:45 a.m. Eastern time. And it comes as Facebook is going through a separate crisis after a former employee filed a whistleblower complaint with federal authorities claiming the company hid information that showed it contributed to global unrest and misinformation. We begin today at the White House, where President Biden said the federal government could breach its $28.4 trillion debt limit unless Republicans join Democrats in voting to raise it sometime in the next 2 weeks. The president spoke to reporters about it from the state dining room.
Here's the deal. There's a cap on what we can borrow called the debt limit, and only Congress can raise or lower that debt limit. So let me be really clear. This is really important to know. Raising the debt limit is about paying off our old debts. It has nothing to do with any new spending being considered. It has nothing to do with my plan for infrastructure or building back better. Zero. Zero. Both of which, I might add, are paid for. So if we're going to make good on what's already been approved by previous Congresses and previous presidents and parties, we have to pay for it. Social Security benefits, the American people are promised, salaries for servicemen and women, benefits for veterans. We're going to have to raise the debt limit if we're going to meet those obligations. And raising the debt limit is usually a bipartisan undertaking, and it should be. That's what is not happening today. The reason we have to raise the debt limit is in part because of the reckless tax and spending policies under the previous Trump administration. In 4 years, they incurred nearly $8 trillion. In 4 years, $8 trillion in additional debt and bills we have to now pay off. That's more than a quarter of the entire debt incurred now outstanding after more than 200 years. And Republicans in Congress raised the debt 3 times when Donald Trump was president, and each time with Democrat support. But now they won't raise it, even though they're responsible for more than $8 trillion in bills incurred in 4 years under the previous administration. That's what we'd be paying off. They won't raise it, even though defaulting on the debt would lead to a self-inflicted wound that takes our economy over a cliff and risks jobs and retirement savings, Social Security benefits, salaries for service members, benefits for veterans, and so much more. A failure to raise the debt limit will call into question Congress's willingness to meet our obligations that we've already incurred. Not new ones, we've already incurred. This is going to undermine the safety of U.S. Treasury securities, and it will threaten the reserve status of the dollar as the world's currency that the world relies on.
President's words come after the House of Representatives passed and sent a bill to the Senate late last month that would suspend the debt limit through the end of 2022. But in the Senate, Republicans have twice blocked action to pass it. Here's more with the president.
Not only are Republicans refusing to do their job, they're threatening to use the power, their power, to prevent us from doing our job, saving the economy from a catastrophic event. I think, quite frankly, it's hypocritical, dangerous, and disgraceful. Their obstruction and irresponsibility knows absolutely no bounds, excuse me, especially as we're clawing our way out of this pandemic. Democrats will meet our responsibility and obligation to this country. We're not expecting Republicans to do their part. They made it clear from the beginning. We tried asking to no avail. We're just asking them not to use procedural tricks to block us from doing the job that they won't do. Meteor is headed to crash into our economy. Democrats are willing to do all the work stopping it. Republicans just have to let us do our job. Just get out of the way. If you don't want to help save the country, get out of the way so you don't destroy it. We don't have time to delay with elaborate procedural schemes, which Republicans' proposals require. Scores of votes without any certainty at all, many of which have nothing to do with the debt limit at all. And that's when accidents happen.
Economists say that a debt default could have catastrophic consequences. Moody's Analytics warned last month that a U.S. default could cause a loss of almost 6 million jobs and spike interest rates on mortgages, consumer loans, and commercial debt. And last week, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned Congress that the government would run out of cash to pay its bills by October 18th. Today, at the White House, President Biden was asked if he could guarantee the U.S. would not go over the debt limit.
Can you guarantee that the U.S. will not breach the debt ceiling, that will not happen?
No, I can't. That's up to Mitch McConnell.
So it is possible that the U.S. will not pay its debt. That is possible.
I can't believe that will be the end result because the consequence is so dire. I don't believe that. But can I guarantee it? If I could, I would, but I can't.
President Biden at the White House. You can see the entire event on our website at cspan.org. On Capitol Hill, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said that if the debt issue is not resolved this week, he will cancel a planned district work period, which is scheduled to start this weekend. Here are his leader time remarks from the Senate floor.
Before the end of this week, the Senate must get a bill to the president's desk to address the acute crisis of the debt limit. President Biden was crystal clear in his speech this morning. If Republicans don't get out of the way and let the Senate take action now, our government will in all likelihood enter default for the first time ever. Sadly, the Republican position as the party of default has now become so extreme that they've blocked every single attempt to prevent a default from happening, putting our country in serious, serious danger. They've gone so far as rejecting their own requests for how the debt ceiling should be raised. Their own requests. We're putting those in action. They're now saying no. Why do you think? Why do you think? And now the Republican leader has repeatedly stated that the Democrats must raise the debt ceiling on our own, and he's directly cited precedents of 2003, 2004, and 2006, when the Senate voted to raise the debt ceiling by a majority vote. But what he conveniently and repeatedly ignores, and he knows better, he ignores that in each of those examples, the minority allowed an up or down vote without a partisan filibuster. In other words, the other side said, get us the 50 votes, and we won't make you get to 60. That's just what we're asking for now. We're proposing the same offer now, which Leader McConnell has cited. Let us vote to raise the debt ceiling without a partisan filibuster. In fact, this was the thrust of my consent request last week, which would have resolved this Republican-driven default crisis with an up or down vote. Republicans could have gotten their chance to vote no, and we could all have put an end to this needless impasse. But given the easiest way out of the mess, the Republicans still refused to take yes for an answer. Now our country's on the brink of a crisis whose consequences will reverberate around the world. The bottom line is this chamber must pass legislation to avoid a default. Accordingly, I will soon file cloture on the House-passed proposal that will suspend the debt limit until December of 2022. We aren't asking Republicans to support it when it comes time for a vote. We only ask that they get out of the way as Democrats pass it on our own, just as the majority party did in the early 2000s. It's really that simple. If Republicans want to vote to stop payments from going to Social Security recipients or veterans, then be my guest. But they ought to get out of the way and let the legislation pass the Senate. The fact is, we don't have the luxury of waiting until October 18th to extend the debt ceiling. Even a near miss can have dramatic consequences. Every single day we delay taking action, we increase the chances of doing irreversible damage to our global financial system, our economic recovery, and trust in our country's ability to pay its debts. So again, we will need to get a bill extending the debt ceiling to the President's desk by the end of this week. We aren't asking Republicans to vote yes, even though it's debt that they incurred. We are simply asking that they get out of the way.
Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer earlier this afternoon. Across the aisle, the Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, sent a letter to President Biden this morning that said in part, quote, "We have no list of demands. For 2.5 months, we simply have warned that since your party wishes to govern alone, it must handle the debt limit alone as well." You can read the entire letter on the minority leader's Twitter page at Leader McConnell. He also talked about the debt limit in his leader time remarks today.
For the last few weeks, Washington Democrats tried to forget that they lined up to oppose debt limit increases during unified Republican government. They pretended these votes are always bipartisan. Well, that was simply not true. So now our colleagues have moved on to yet another new argument that is equally flimsy. Now, they claim they'd be perfectly happy to handle this responsibility with 51 votes done one way, but they'd rather risk the nation's credit than doing it with 51 votes a slightly different way. Two different ways to achieve 51 votes. I'm not kidding. This is the position they're taking. The president said it today. The reconciliation procedure would be slightly more inconvenient, they said. A few more days, a few more votes they'd rather duck. The Democratic leaders running America are saying with a straight face that the entire U.S. economy should live or die based on the procedural convenience of Washington Democrats. Now, I've got no problem using the party line process over and over and over to spend trillions and transform the country. But now, for this purpose only, they suddenly and mysteriously find it unappealing. Democrats could not be more capable of handling this on their own. Just months ago, the Democratic leader won new powers to reuse reconciliation over and over. They don't even need our consent to set a vote at 51 instead of 60. They need even less help raising the debt limit than majorities needed in the past. So trust me, Madam President, if Republicans were sitting on a hidden veto power to stop reconciliation bills, you would have heard about it way back in the springtime. The majority doesn't need our votes. They just want a bipartisan shortcut around procedural hurdles they can actually clear on their own. And they want that shortcut so they can pivot right back to partisan spending as fast as possible. They want a bipartisan shortcut to get right back to more partisan hardball. And Republicans have spent 2.5 months, this is no surprise, 2.5 months ago, explaining that this is the way they needed to go forward on the debt ceiling. This unified Democratic government is having trouble governing. They couldn't even pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which the president negotiated and the Speaker of the House promised would pass last week. The majority needs to stop sleepwalking toward yet another preventable crisis. Democrats need to tackle the debt limit. We gave them a roadmap and 3 months' notice. I suggest that our colleagues get moving.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell earlier today on the Senate floor. Arizona Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema, who has said she opposes the president's Build Back Better agenda, also is facing the heat. She heard from it on Sunday from a group of activists who followed her into a public restroom. A video posted on the Twitter account of a group calling itself Living United for Change in Arizona shows a group of activists following the senator on her way out of a classroom at Arizona State University and into the bathroom. Here's part of what that sounded like.
Okay, I'll be back.
Sit down, we want to talk to you real quick. Can we talk to you real quick?
Hi, actually, I am heading out.
Right now is a real moment that our people need in order for us to be able to talk about what's really happening. We need a Build Back Better plan right now.
We knocked on doors. We need solutions.
The Build Back Better plan has the solutions that we need.
We knocked on doors for you to get you elected. And just how we got you elected, we can get you out of office if you don't support what you promised us.
Senator Sinema, who teaches social work classes at the university, released a statement on Twitter today about the event. It says, in part, yesterday's behavior was not legitimate protest. It is unacceptable for activist organizations to instruct their members to jeopardize themselves by engaging in unlawful activities, such as gaining entry to closed university buildings, disrupting learning environments, and filming students in a restroom. Remember, whenever the Senate is in session, you can see it on C-SPAN 2 or with our new C-SPAN Now app. You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back to Washington Today. Dr. Anthony Fauci clarified that he is not calling on Americans to cancel Christmas this year and is, in fact, urging them to have, quote, a good and normal holiday. Dr. Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, made headlines on Sunday after he told CBS News that it's too soon to tell whether it will be safe for Americans to safely gather for Christmas. Here he explains what he meant and why he thinks the U.S. could be turning a corner on COVID-19.
If we keep going in the direction of a diminution in hospitalization and cases, that the deaths will start coming down. Having said that, not to diminish that that's good positive news, is that we still have so many people who are not vaccinated that we better be careful that we don't say we're out of the woods, because we might not be out of the woods in the sense of no more COVID around at all. You know, I also said something over the weekend that was taken completely out of context. I was asked, what could we predict for this winter, for like December and Christmas?
I was going to ask you.
Yeah, I mean, I say you hold off on that. I said, we don't know, because we've seen slopes that went down and then came back up. The best way to assure that we'll be in good shape as we get into the winter would be to get more and more people vaccinated. That was misinterpreted as my saying we can't spend Christmas with our families, which was absolutely not the case. I will be spending Christmas with my family. I encourage people, particularly the vaccinated people who are protected, to have a good, normal Christmas with your family. But just the way all of the other disinformation goes around, you say something talking about a landmark of a time and it gets misinterpreted that I'm saying you can't spend family Christmas time, which is nonsense. You can.
And your point is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that it's when you're in a pandemic, it is very hard to predict 2 months out still.
That was, Kate, my absolute point in response to the question that was asked of me. Exactly as you said, I was asked to predict what the state of the pandemic would be when we get to December. And my response was, that's really dependent on us. It's difficult to predict, but the one thing we do have within our power to do is to make sure that there are less and less cases, and that diminishing slope that's going down continues to go down. And the way we can do that is by getting more and more people vaccinated. That was the point that I was making, not that you're not going to be able to spend Christmas with your family. I certainly am, that's for sure.
Dr. Anthony Fauci on CNN. Yesterday on CBS News' Face the Nation program, Dr. Fauci stressed the need to concentrate on bringing COVID-19 cases down and not trying to, quote, jump ahead by weeks or months and say what we're going to do at a particular time. You can hear all five Sunday TV talk shows right here on C-SPAN Radio each Sunday afternoon. You can get schedule information on our new C-SPAN Now app and follow us on Twitter at C-SPAN Radio. A new report released yesterday shows how a group of world leaders, powerful politicians, billionaires, and others are using offshore accounts to shield assets that are collectively worth trillions of dollars. The investigation, called the Pandora Papers, was conducted by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. It involves 600 journalists from 150 media outlets in 117 countries. Hundreds of politicians, celebrities, religious leaders, and drug dealers use shell companies and other tactics to hide their investments in mansions, exclusive beachfront property, yachts, and other assets. Current and former politicians named in the report are Jordan's King Abdullah II, former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair, and the leaders from the Czech Republic, Kenya, and Ecuador. It also named the associates of both Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan and Russian President Vladimir Putin. The investigation dug into accounts registered in the British Virgin Islands, Hong Kong, Belize, and also the U.S., including 81 in South Dakota and 37 accounts in Florida. You can read the report at ICIJ.org. In Michigan today, Governor Gretchen Whitmer vetoed four Republican-sponsored bills that she said would weaken voting rights and suppress votes. Two of the bills would limit access to Michigan's voter database and keep voting systems from being connected to the internet on Election Day. Another would have expanded the types of buildings that can serve as polling places. Governor Whitmer talked about her decision at the Detroit NAACP Freedom Fund dinner last night.
And the coordinated attack on voting rights is designed to systematically disenfranchise Black voters, communities of color, older voters, college kids. And this attack is built on lies. The big lie and a lot of small lies, too.
Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer yesterday. And in Florida, Casey DeSantis, the wife of Governor Ron DeSantis, has been diagnosed with breast cancer. In a statement, the Republican governor called the First Lady and mother of three a, quote, true fighter, and that she will have not only my unwavering support, but the support of our entire family, as well as the prayers and well wishes from Floridians across our state. Former White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham says it was a mistake to work for President Trump. In her new book, I'll Take Your Questions, which is out this week, she talks about taking over as press secretary in 2019 after Sarah Huckabee Sanders left. Her book is the first one from a former Trump White House aide. And in an interview on Good Morning America, anchor George Stephanopoulos asked her why she waited until now to speak out against the ex-president.
The book is kind of a brutal read. You detail 4 years of toxicity, abuses of power, a culture of casual dishonesty, but you stayed until the final 2 weeks. I mean, the inevitable first question is, what took you so long?
Yeah, that's a fair question, and it's a complicated question. I went into the Trump campaign a true believer and a true loyalist, and then
but you had actually worked against him in the primaries, hadn't you?
No, I had worked in very, very early. I'd worked on a couple of minor campaigns, but it was when the field was at 15 or 16, so I hadn't worked against him at all. And when I worked his first rally, I was absolutely impressed by the crowd and the reaction that he got, and I liked the way that he truly was giving a voice to people who felt forgotten. As I went through my years, I spent a huge amount of time on the East Wing, and so I was almost shielded sometimes from a lot of the toxic nature of the West Wing and the administration. When I went to the West Wing is when I actually started to see what it was really like, and I regretted that decision immediately.
Stephanie Grisham was one of the first staffers to move from the Trump campaign into the White House. She worked there for almost the entirety of his presidency, and in the interview, she talked about the White House's working environment.
But you were talking about this culture of casual dishonesty mm-hmm. at the White House. So you were, as press secretary, even if you weren't giving briefings, yeah. enabling that culture, weren't you?
Yes, I was. And I've reflected on that, and I regret that. And especially now watching him and so many people push the false election narrative, I now want to, in whatever way I can, educate the public about the behaviors within the White House, because it does look like he's going to try to run in 2024.
Do you believe he will?
I didn't at first, but I'm starting to believe he will. I mean, he's clearly the front runner in the Republican Party. Everybody's showing their fealty to him. He's on his revenge tour for, you know, people who dared to vote for impeachment. And I want to just warn people that once he takes office, if he were to win, he doesn't have to worry about reelection anymore. He will be about revenge. He will probably have some pretty draconian policies that go on. There were conversations a lot of times that people would say, that'll be the second term, that'll be the second term, meaning we won't have to worry about, you know, a reelection.
You're right that you were concerned about a young press aide who was getting inappropriate attention and comments from President Trump. Should you have done more to protect her?
I don't know if I could have. There's not an HR department at the White House where you can go and say, hey, the President of the United States is acting inappropriately. I didn't feel comfortable talking
to the Chief of Staff.
I didn't feel comfortable talking to Mark Meadows. I don't believe he would have done anything. So I did the best I could in terms of never letting her be alone with him in the cabin. I tried to keep her off trips as often as I could. I did the best I could, I think, in that environment.
Former White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham on Good Morning America. Today marks the start of the new Supreme Court term, and with it, a number of firsts. First-time Justice Amy Coney Barrett takes to the bench for in-person oral arguments. First time the court has returned in person since March 2020, and the first time they're doing live audio for an in-person oral argument. Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who recently tested positive for the coronavirus, participated in today's events remotely. Masks were required for everyone in the courtroom, but were optional for the justices and attorneys arguing at the podium. Only Justice Sonia Sotomayor was seen wearing one. Others in attendance included retired Justice Anthony Kennedy and the spouses of Chief Justice John Roberts, Stephen Breyer, and Amy Coney Barrett. Here is Chief Justice Roberts opening the court.
I have the honor to announce on behalf of the court that the October 2020 term of the Supreme Court of the United States is now closed, and the October 2021 term is now convened. I'd like to begin by noting that Justice Kavanaugh will be participating in the argument today remotely. These orders of the court have been duly entered and certified and filed with the clerk. I am also pleased to welcome Gail Curley as the new marshal of the court. Marshal Curley retired from the United States Army this summer, where she held the rank of colonel and was most recently chief of the National Security Law Division of the Judge Advocate General. We wish her well in her service as the court's 11th marshal, which she commenced on June 21st. We will hear argument first this morning in original case 143, Mississippi against Tennessee. Mr. Coughlin.
Chief Justice John Roberts speaking at the Supreme Court earlier today. We spoke with the Heritage Foundation's John Malcolm and the Constitutional Accountability Center's Elizabeth Wydra. They previewed the new term.
Every year, usually about this time, we hear about the upcoming slate in the court talking about being blockbuster or very important. How does this year compare to previous ones?
I'm not sure who that question is. Go ahead. Elizabeth, you go first, please.
Yeah, sorry to, you know, overuse the term, but if ever blockbuster term were appropriate, you know, this term is definitely going to be an enormous term when it comes to cases of great significance for the country. We have abortion rights, gun laws, issues related to religious instruction in schools. This is a term that is going to be incredibly momentous. And when it comes in the context that we are seeing right now with the public being very concerned about the legitimacy of the court, gosh, all eyes are going to be on the court, and there is going to be a lot that will be worth watching.
John Malcolm, same question to you.
Well, look, every term has its significant decisions, but I agree with Elizabeth that this certainly is a big term. The court's got about half the cases that they're going to end up hearing already scheduled on their docket, and a number of them are significant, including abortion rights and the Second Amendment and religious liberty, all the cases that Elizabeth mentioned, which I think we'll talk about, you know, with respect to how the public feels about the court. I think that the court ought to do what judges always ought to do, which is to tune out all that noise, and just rule according to the facts and the law and the case presented to them.
Mr. Malcolm, then, do you think then this term is shaped in any way by decisions made last term? And I'm particularly talking about the decision made in Texas's abortion law case.
So, no, I don't think so, referring specifically to that case, which doesn't mean that I think Mississippi is going to lose. I think Mississippi is going to win their case. I think the Texas abortion law stood on the way the law was framed and the parties that got sued. It's an unusual law in the sense that it makes clear that no state officials can enforce that law. It's only enforced by private civil lawsuits. So when Planned Parenthood ran to court and sued state officials and sued state court judges, the Supreme Court, 5-4, said, you know, you sued people who have no ability or no role in enforcing this law. But, you know, it's certainly in the background of the Dobbs versus Whole Woman's Health case. That's the Mississippi abortion case. And that is a significant case that Elizabeth, I think, was referring to.
And as you that, we'll talk about specifics in that in a second. But Ms. Wydra, as far as the way that people look at the court compared to decisions made last, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's obviously relevant to public opinion of the court when, you know, there is a ruling, the Texas ruling that you're talking about, which was given on the emergency docket that is also known as the shadow docket, no matter how Justice Alito might object to that term, that's certainly the term that is applied to it. And so I think when people wake up in the morning and there is a ruling that happened overnight, or in this particular case, first the Supreme Court didn't act and the Texas law was able to go into effect, and then the court did act in a one paragraph procedural ruling allowing a law that clearly is unconstitutional under Roe versus Wade to go into effect and functionally gut abortion rights for one state in the country, you know, people are going to start to feel very uneasy about what the court is doing. And I think that that is legitimate, that folks would be concerned about these very woven into the fabric of our nation's existence, you know, the way that a generation of people have grown up, like myself, since Roe versus Wade, assuming that abortion rights are protected across the land, and then to wake up and find out that that might not be true, I think, of course, people are going to feel uneasy. And the court, while they certainly try to tune out, you know, the news, it's clear from their recent speeches that they don't. And I don't think it's necessarily illegitimate for them to be concerned about their credibility. Of course, they should always follow the law. They should always follow the facts. That goes without saying. But the credibility of the Supreme Court depends on the people having confidence in it. And that's something that is important to the institution. It's important to it working properly. And so I think that, you know, we've seen the Chief Justice concerned about the credibility of the court and wishing to keep the court thought of highly, but public opinion polls show that, especially after that Texas abortion ruling, that the public has concerns.
That was the Heritage Foundation's John Malcolm and the Constitutional Accountability Center's Elizabeth Wydra speaking on this morning's Washington Journal program. You can see the entire program on our website at cspan.org/WJ. And remember that all of our coverage is online anytime at cspan.org. And if you missed any of this program, you can find it on our new C-SPAN Now app at cspan.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like more on the stories that are shaping Washington delivered right to your inbox, you can subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Gary Sterikoff. Thanks a lot for listening today to Washington Today.